Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are attempting something pretty ambitious. We are essentially rebooting the operating system of the Western mind.
Yeah, you could definitely say that.
Because we've spent a lot of time recently sort of mud wrestling in the gritty sensory world of British empiricism, hanging out with guys like Francis Bacon and Thomas Hobbes.
Right, the guys who thought the only way to find the truth was to poke it with a stick or measure it with a ruler.
Exactly. It's a very tactile, almost blue-collar way of doing philosophy. Like, if I can't touch it...
It's not real.
Right, it's just not real. But today we are crossing the English Channel, we're leaving the mud behind, and entering a room that is sterile, geometric, and just completely obsessed with absolute certainty.
It's a total pivot.
It really is. We are talking about the rise of continental rationalism and the man who arguably started modern philosophy, which is René Descartes.
And if the British empiricists were all about learning by looking... The continental rationalists, led by Descartes, were fundamentally about learning by thinking.
And based on the source material we're covering today, this is a lecture series specifically focused on that transition from Hobbes to Descartes. This isn't just about a guy coming up with a catchy slogan like, I think, therefore I am.
No, it's much bigger than that.
He's trying to do something way more radical. He is attempting to rebuild the entire structure of human knowledge from zero, using a method that looks a lot less like biology and a lot more like geometry.
That is exactly the mission. Descartes looked at the messy, uncertain state of philosophy and science in the 17th century and just decided it wasn't good enough.
It was too sloppy for him.
Way too sloppy. He wanted to find a way to know things with 100% certainty. And to do that, he realized he had to basically break reality before he could fix it.
So that is our mission for you on this deep dive. We're going to unpack how Descartes tried to construct this perfect system of knowledge, why he thought your senses were essentially lying to you, and why, strangely enough, he decided that you actually can't do physics without God.
It's a really fascinating architecture he builds.
Let's start with the context, though, because the sources make it clear you really can't understand Descartes without understanding who he was fighting against.
Right, the rival team.
Yeah, we have these two opposing teams in the 17th century, Team Britain and Team Continent. So on one side, you have the empiricists like Hobbes and Bacon.
And the lecture refers to them as nominalists.
Nominalist, which sounds distinctively academic, but let's unpack that because it seems crucial to their whole worldview. My understanding is that this is basically about labels versus reality.
Precisely. A nominalist believes that universals, so big concepts like justice or humanity or even just the color red, they don't actually exist out there in reality.
They're just names.
Right. Nomen is Latin for name. They're just labels we slap onto groups of things because it's convenient for our brains.
So for them, there isn't some mystical essence of tree floating around in the universe.
Right.
There are just individual oaks and pines and birches, and we just group them together and say tree so we don't have to list every single one every time we talk.
Exactly. And because they believe reality is just this collection of individual physical objects, they think the only way to learn is through the senses.
You actually have to go look at the trees?
You have to look at them. It's all about material causes. Matter in motion. You are building your knowledge from the outside in.
Okay, so that's Team Britain. Very grounded, very skeptical of invisible concepts. Now enter Team Continent. Descartes.
Right, so Descartes represents the complete opposite tradition. He is a conceptualist. He believes that universals actually do exist, but they exist as concepts within the mind.
Okay, so we don't just learn from the outside in.
No, we have an intuitive, innate knowledge of general principles.
So while Hobbes is out there in the forest measuring specific trees to understand nature, Descartes is just sitting in his room thinking, I have the perfect concept of a triangle in my head.
And I didn't find this under a rock.
Right. It's a perfect truth that just lives inside me.
And he would argue that the idea of the triangle is more perfect and in a weird way more real than any triangle you could ever draw on a piece of paper. Because the drawing is always going to be a little wobbly, right? But the concept in your mind is precise.
Which leads to a really tricky part of the lecture.
Yeah.
But I actually think it's the key to understanding why these two camps hated each other's ideas so much.
Yeah.
Both of these guys, Hobbes and Descartes, actually agree on one specific mechanism of how the mind works.
Yes. They both hold what's called a representational view of knowledge.
Which is sometimes called the veil of perception, right?
Exactly.
The way I visualize this is like a VR headset or maybe a movie screen. Whether you are Hobbes or Descartes, you agree that we don't look out our windows and see the world directly. We're sort of trapped inside our own skulls watching a screen.
That's a great analogy. You are immediately aware of your ideas, the representations on the screen, not the external objects themselves.
So if you look at a coffee cup, you aren't seeing the physical cup.
You are seeing your brain's rendering of the cup.
So we are all effectively trapped in our own internal movie theater. But here is where the massive split happens. For Hobbes, the movie is a documentary.
Right, the images on the screen are coming from cameras.
Our eyes and ears. They're filming the outside world.
Sense data, literally atoms bumping into your retinas. The film is entirely determined by the outside world.
But for Descartes, because he's a conceptualist, some of those movies aren't documentaries at all. They're basically animations generated by the projector itself.
Yes. He calls them intuitive ideas. Descartes argues that because the mind has its own structure, some of our knowledge like logic or math or the idea of God doesn't come from the senses at all.
It comes from the mind's own operating system, if you will.
Exactly. Which brings us to, arguably, the biggest wrestling match of the 17th century, mind versus body.
Oh, yeah. Because if Hobbes thinks everything is just atoms bumping into atoms, that has some pretty terrifying implications for human beings.
It leads straight to materialism. Hobbes thought that thoughts were literally just physical movements in the brain, and if thoughts are just physics,
then we are just biological wind-up toys. It's pure determinism.
Exactly. If your brain is just matter in motion, every thought you have, every choice you make, is just the result of a previous physical cause.
You don't have free will.
None. You just have conflicting biological drives, and whichever one is strongest wins. You feel like you're making a choice, but you're really just calculating.
That is such a bleak picture. We're just meat machines.
Meh.
And Descartes clearly wasn't having any of that. He wanted to preserve something special about humanity.
Right. Descartes is a dualist. He essentially slices the human being into two totally distinct substances.
Okay, let's break those down.
First, you have the res extensa, the extended thing. That's the body, which he agrees is a machine. It follows physics. It gets sick. It gets old. It breaks.
But then you have the second thing.
The res cogitans, the thinking thing.
Right.
The mind or the soul.
And since the mind isn't made of matter, it doesn't have to follow the laws of physics.
Correct. And this is exactly how he saves free will. He is a libertarian in the philosophical sense, meaning the will is entirely free from physical determination.
Because it's non-physical, so it stands outside that chain of cause and effect.
Yes, it can sort of reach down and steer the machine.
So Hobbes looks at humanity and sees a driverless car following a GPS track. Descartes sees a car with a ghost in the driver's seat.
The ghost in the machine. That is the classic critique of Descartes. But for him, it was the absolute only way to preserve moral responsibility and the dignity of the human soul. Because if we are just matter, we're just dust in the wind.
Okay, so we have the battlefield set for you. On one side, you've got sensor data and determinism. On the other, you have innate ideas and free will. Now let's talk about the strategy. Because Descartes isn't just making claims here. He is introducing a completely new method for finding truth. The source material calls it the geometrical model.
This is a huge shift. So Hobbes used what's called a reconstitutive method. He gathers facts, empirical generalizations, and tries to build a structure from them.
It's like science as we normally think of it today, right?
Mm.
Gather data, find a pattern.
Exactly. But Descartes thinks that is super shaky ground because if I measure 1,000 swans and they are all white, I might confidently conclude all swans are white.
But then you travel to Australia and find one black swan, and your whole truth collapses.
Right. Empirical knowledge is always just probable. It is never certain. And Descartes was frankly terrified of skepticism. It was this rising tide in his day.
Mm.
People were starting to ask, how do we know anything is true?
So probability just wasn't good enough for him. He wanted absolute bedrock certainty.
So he looks at the one field that never seems to be wrong, which is geometry.
Oh, that makes sense. Because in geometry, you don't go around measuring triangles in the wild. You start with axioms.
Self-evident truths, like a straight line is the shortest distance between two points.
Then you use logic to deduce conclusions.
And if the starting point is true and the logic is valid, the conclusion absolutely must be true. It's not probable, it is necessary.
So he essentially wants to turn philosophy into geometry. He wants to find the axioms of reality. But to find a truth that is so solid it cannot possibly be doubted, he has to do something pretty extreme. He basically has to torture his own brain.
He engages in methodological skepticism.
I love this concept so much. It is basically stress testing your own beliefs until they break.
It's a controlled demolition of his own mind. He decides to doubt everything that can possibly be doubted. His senses, his memories, his past beliefs.
I know Bacon wanted to clear away those idols or biases, but Descartes goes totally nuclear. He wants to burn the house to the ground to see if anything in the ashes is actually fireproof.
And this leads to his famous thought experiment, the malign demon.
Yes. This is the part that always feels like a sci-fi movie to me. It's The Matrix, but like 300 years early.
It really is. Descartes asks himself, what if I'm not making mistakes? What if there is a powerful evil spirit, a malign demon, who has devoted his entire existence to deceiving me?
So the sky isn't actually blue, the air isn't warm, it is just this demon stimulating my brain to think those things.
Right. And if that is even possible, then you can't trust science. You can't trust that the beaker in front of you is actually boiling. You can't trust your own eyes.
You are just locked in a permanent hallucination.
Exactly.
So he is in this incredibly deep hole of doubt.
Mm-hmm.
He doubts the world. He doubts his own body. But then he hits bedrock. He finds the one thing the demon cannot fake.
The catito. I think, therefore, I am.
Because even if the demon is tricking me, I have to exist to be tricked.
Yes. Even if I am constantly doubting, there must be a doubter doing the doubting.
Okay, so boom, he exists. Great. But he's just a thinking speck in a potentially fake universe. How does he get from I exist to science is real? Because this is where the lecture takes a turn that I think surprises a lot of modern listeners.
Yeah.
He brings in God.
And he doesn't just bring God in as some sort of religious comfort. He uses God as a literal piece of engineering in his logical system.
But wait, Hobbes had a God too, though. Why wasn't Hobbes' version of God enough to solve this?
Well, Hobbes had a first efficient cause, a prime mover, basically the guy who flicked the first domino of the Big Bang. But Hobbes' God doesn't intervene. He just set the physics in motion and stepped back.
Right. A deist God doesn't care if I'm hallucinating.
Exactly. That doesn't help Descartes with his demon problem at all. So Descartes argues that God must be more than just a cause. God must be good.
The logical thesis.
Yes. The argument is structural. He starts with the idea that he has this concept of a perfect infinite being in his mind. And he argues he couldn't have invented that idea himself because he's imperfect and finite.
So a finite being can't invent an infinite concept.
Right. Therefore, the idea must have been put there by the infinite being itself. So God exists.
Okay. That's a standard ontological argument. But how does that kill the demon?
Because a perfectly good God would not be a deceiver. Deception is a flaw. It implies weakness or malice. And a good God would not create a human being with faculties like reason and senses that are fundamentally broken.
I see. So if God is the manufacturer of my mind, and God is fundamentally good, then the product shouldn't be defective.
Exactly. If I use my reason correctly, if I follow the strict rules of logic, I can actually trust what I see.
So the good God acts as the guarantor of science.
He is the structural bridge between the mind inside and the physical world outside.
That is incredibly convenient, but also, you have to admit, brilliantly constructed. He uses theology to mathematically save science from skepticism.
It makes him incredibly optimistic. The skeptics of his day were saying we can never really know reality. And Descartes is saying, no, the universe is completely intelligible because the creator is rational and good. We can figure all of this out.
So we have defeated the demon. We have brain we can trust, courtesy of the manufacturer's warranty. Now, what's the actual user manual? Because the source mentions these four rules from his Discourse on Method. This is his toolkit for thinking like a geometer.
Right. These are the rules to ensure you don't fall back into the demon's trap. Rule number one is the most famous, which is intuition. You should only accept ideas that are clear and distinct.
Clear and distinct. He uses that phrase constantly. It's like his version of high-definition thought.
Pretty much. It means an idea that is so present and transparent to the mind that it simply cannot be doubted. Like 2 + 2 = 4. Or I exist.
You don't need evidence for it. You just see it.
Yes.
Okay. Then rule two is analysis.
Break every problem down. Don't try to solve the entire universe or the human body all at once. Break it down into little chunks until you reach those simple, clear, distinct atoms of thought.
Then rule three is synthesis.
Build it back up. Start with the simple truths and deductively chain them together to explain complex things. It's literally like building a Lego castle. Start with the individual bricks, the clear ideas, and snap them together logically.
And finally, enumeration.
Check your work. Review every single step of the chain to make sure you didn't skip a logical beat. It's exactly how you do a geometric proof.
Now, we touched on this earlier, but I want to clarify the innate ideas part. Because when Descartes talks about these clear and distinct truths coming from inside us, people often confuse this with Plato.
Oh, yeah, that's a common mix-up. Plato thought innate meant remembered. Like you knew the perfect truth in a past life, you forgot it when you were born into a body, and now you're just recalling it. Descartes isn't saying that at all.
He's saying it's structural.
Yes. Think of it like a computer. Plato thinks you have files saved on your hard drive from a previous user. Descartes thinks you have firmware pre-installed by the manufacturer.
Oh, the firmware analogy is perfect. So the capacity to process logic,
yeah,
the idea of perfection, the idea of God, these are just preloaded. He calls it the natural light.
Which sounds super mystical, but he really just means the natural capacity of the human intellect. When you see that a triangle has three sides, you aren't guessing. You see the truth of it by the natural light of reason.
It's not a divine beam from heaven. It's just the mind doing what it was built to do.
Exactly.
So we have the method. We have the confidence. And this leads to Descartes' lasting legacy in epistemology, which is just the theory of knowledge. The source calls it foundationalism.
Foundationalism is the idea that knowledge is like a skyscraper. You cannot start building until you have a bedrock foundation of indubitable certainty.
Because if the foundation has even a tiny crack, if there is even a 1% chance it's wrong, the whole building is completely unsafe.
Right. And this is a massive departure from how the British empiricists worked. They were evidentialists.
So for an empiricist like Locke, who comes a bit later, knowledge is more like a court case.
Yes. You look at the evidence. You have five witnesses who say they saw the tree. Is it theoretically possible they are all lying? Sure.
But the evidence is strong enough to convict. You proportion your belief to the probability.
But Descartes is an absolutist. He doesn't want beyond a reasonable doubt. He wants beyond any doubt whatsoever.
Which leads to the famous story of the stove. We have to talk about this because it perfectly captures the sheer weirdness of his method.
Set the scene for us. It's a great historical anecdote.
It is one of my favorite philosophical stories because it's so mundane but so bizarre. So Descartes is a young man traveling in the Netherlands. It's the freezing dead of winter. He shuts himself in a stove-heated room, which is essentially a small room built around a large heater, just to do his thinking. He's sitting by the fire, nice and warm.
And he starts his meditation.
He starts applying his methodological skepticism. He looks at his own hands and says, "Can I be absolutely sure these hands exist? No, the demon could be faking them."
So he's sitting there physically warming his hands while logically convincing himself that he might not actually have hands.
The contradiction is just hilarious. He's actively feeding wood into the fire to warm a physical body that his philosophy dictates might not even exist.
And later critics, especially the pragmatists, pointed to this exact moment and said, this proves his doubt is fake. It's just theatrical.
Because if you really genuinely doubted you had a body, you wouldn't bother feeding the fire. You just sit there and freeze.
Exactly. A real doubt changes your behavior. Descartes' doubt is purely intellectual. But you know Descartes would fiercely defend himself here. He'd say, I know practically that I'm cold, but I'm not doing practice right now. I'm doing science.
I need to know if I can prove I have a body with the exact same certainty that I can prove math.
Yes. It shows his utter commitment to the method. He's willing to suspend his common sense entirely in service of building this logical architecture. He wants to know what is logically true, not just what practically works.
Even if it makes him look a bit ridiculous to anyone watching him put wood in the stove.
Right.
So let's zoom out a bit and look at the map we've drawn for you today. We started in the mud with Hobbes, this gritty world of matter, senses, and probability. And we have essentially climbed up into this crystalline palace of Descartes, a world of mind, innate ideas, and absolute mathematical certainty.
That is the great shift of the 17th century. And it completely creates the fault line that runs through the next 300 years of Western thought. Rationalism versus empiricism.
Do we trust the logic in our heads or the data from our eyes?
Exactly.
It also frames how we argue about truth today. Yeah. I mean, the source material makes the point that Christian apologetics is basically just applied epistemology. When religious people argue for God, they often use Cartesian logic, these foundational deductive proofs. But when atheists argue against it, they often use empiricist logic, saying, well, where's the physical evidence?
We are still fighting the exact same battle. We're just using slightly different vocabulary. We're still debating whether truth comes from inside through reason or outside through observation.
But there is one loose thread that really sticks with me from all this. Descartes' entire system, his defeat of the demon, his ultimate trust in science, it all relied on that one specific pin, the goodness of God.
That is the linchpin. It holds the whole geometrical structure together.
He absolutely needed a benevolent creator to guarantee that his cognitive software wasn't secretly malware. Without that, he was stuck in the hallucination.
Correct. Without God, the science falls apart.
So here is a provocative thought to leave you with as you go about your week. We live in a modern world that is largely secular, We love science. We love reason. We trust that our brains can understand the universe. But we have largely discarded the good God part of Descartes' equation.
We kept the building, but we basically knocked out the foundation.
Exactly. So if you remove the divine guarantor, what happens to the guarantee? If we are just evolved primates with brains designed strictly for survival and not necessarily for absolute truth, how do we actually know we aren't deceiving ourselves?
Are we basically back in the cage with the malign demon?
Or maybe we never left. It's a question that keeps philosophers awake at night, probably in stove-heated rooms to this very day. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.